Good morning, everyone. Welcome to week 5 of Effective and Motivated Living. This series, just by the way, continues on till next week. Next week is the last week, the week before Shavuot of this series. Then we're going to take a couple of weeks break because I'm going overseas, but I'll tell you the exact dates. Well, it's a good thing, but... And then next week I'll give you the dates and the topic of the new series. Okay, so we've been working through the different aspects based on the works of Rabbi Twersky. That article on happiness and so on. So last week just a bit of review first of all. Last week we talked about motivation, the concept of motivation, drive, desire. And we said it's all guided by this concept called Ratzon, which is a will, a deep will that we have to make things happen. We established that there's actually no such thing as lack of motivation. As Rabbi Twersky says, there's just either positive motivation or negative motivation. So we don't get out of bed to do what we need to do, we're very motivated, just motivated to stay in bed rather than to get up and actually accomplish what we need to accomplish. Or when we get angry and we don't have the motivation to stay calm and to control our temper, we do have a motivation, it's just negative motivation to get angry and get off our chest, which has short-term benefit, and we're unable to have the positive motivation to control ourselves and get on top of our character and so on. So we quoted last week a saying from the Talmud that says, or actually it's based on a Zohar really, which says that nothing stands before the will. Ein lecha davar omed b'fnei haratzon. And we explained it, that it's not just that, it's not the same when there's a will, there's a way, it's more the other way around. It's more that nothing stands in the way of creating a will. In other words, at the end of the day, we choose and we are masters over our own will. So we began to explain that there's different desires, different wills, ratzon, that comes from different places. So the will that comes from the area of our personality that is more animalistic, which explains the animal soul, which sometimes is fed erroneously, as we've been talking over the last few weeks, by interfering thoughts coming from our subconscious with the mistaken will to desire us, to protect us. That's where the negative motivation often comes from, and because that motivation is based on those things, which is self-preservation, egocentricity, instant gratification, short-term, self-protection and laziness, and the lack of will to move beyond ourselves. As I brought last week, one of the ethics who quotes a midrash that by definition and by default, everything physical doesn't grow. That's why the midrash says that every blade of grass needs its own angel to push it to grow, because physical things, the way they're created, actually are not driven to grow. The human being can grow, but we need a lot of work and investment and effort to do that. So what we explained is that we need a change. We need to build and reveal the will that comes from who we really are, which is our essence, our values. And we do that by creating a new mindset to get the conscious mind to be more in control, as we've been explaining. And do that by connecting it to the very essence of who we are, because at the very deep core of who we are, we want to have positive motivation, and we want to grow as human beings, we want to become better people. And also we connect it to the level of action, which we explained a few weeks ago, because when we do things positive, the heart follows as well. And just in summary, last week we talked about 4 things that we can do to be able to do that, which is we need to train ourselves to think, and think long term. Because normally what happens is the negative motivation comes from short-term gratification, short-term benefit, things that just seem right at the moment without thinking of the consequences long-term. So we get off our chest to get really angry with someone, that's a short-term motivation. Whereas if we trained ourselves to think long-term, we'd work through in our mind, and then our mind would control our heart, as we know, that it's not worth it, because ultimately it's better as a human being, and better effect and more effective for the friendship and relationships not to get angry, and so on and so forth with every negative and positive motivation. The second thing we said we need to do is also in the area of thinking. It's all about getting the conscious mind back in control. is to think about our goals and our values, which begin, like Stephen Covey says, begin with the end in mind. What is our core values? What is our life mission statement? What do we really want to be? What type of person do we want to be? The third thing we talk about is just generally to create a growth mindset. It's about always having that mindset to grow as a human being. And finally, we said about putting it into action, to always start with one thing at a time, not to over create expectation, but the salami method, as we called it, to do one thing at a time, which often brings motivation and nurtures the motivation. Now, what I want to do today is develop this idea and show how powerful it can really be and what it really means. And what I'm going to do is do something different. What I mean by that is I'm going to try and convey an idea which I heard just a short while ago. I heard a fascinating explanation on something. In a shiur given by Rabbi, I like to give credit to people when I get their insights from them, so it's by Rabbi Y.Y. Jacobson, who is Yossi Jacobson, who's an amazing speaker and orator and thinker. And he bases it, which I later looked up, and he bases the thought on one of the greatest philosophers of Jewish thinking, which is the Maharal of Prague, who lived from 1520 to 1609, Rabbi Yehuda Levoy, who lived in Prague. And it's an amazing insight and interpretation on a piece of Talmud, but it brings out the journey of life, which is so true and so relevant for so many people. Now, a bit of introduction. I once explained this, but sometimes there's a section of the Talmud which we call, and you'll see at the end why this all got to do with what we've been talking about in the last few, I'm not just sharing it because I saw a nice thing so I want to share it, which wouldn't be a bad idea either, but I'm sharing it because it really goes to the heart of what we've been talking about and the different layers of the person and how they operate. Often in the Talmud was written in the first few centuries. I explained this last week, actually, which was written in a very tough time under tremendous Roman persecution and so on, but the greatest Jewish thought came out in that era. And today, the Talmud is the basis of all Jewish learning. But because the Talmud was written by such amazing sages and such great people, holy people and thinking people and such giants, Torah giants, often what happens is they write, the Talmud is written, particularly when it talks about stories and midrashic accounts of things, often writes in very cryptic and very brief terminology. And it's left to the commentaries and the commentators throughout the ages, the Maharal being one of them, to decode, so to speak, and to decipher what is actually meant by the Talmud. Sometimes it sounds like almost bizarre, the stuff that's written in the Talmud, and sometimes it sounds like they're telling us information that really doesn't matter and it's irrelevant, and yet in those statements lie very, very deep ideas. So that's a surgeon's warning. I'm going to share with you something the Talmud says, which sounds ridiculous, and I'm going to show you what it really means, and it's quite fascinating. So let me give you the context. This Talmud is based on a story in Tanakh, a biblical story, which goes like this. Towards the end, when Moses died, at the end of the Chumash, right, and Tanakh begins, Joshua takes over. Joshua is in the desert with the Jewish people. It's 40 years they've been wandering in the desert. It's now time for them to actually enter the land of Israel. So Joshua does what Moses did 40 years before. He does it a bit differently because the first time it didn't land up very well. And he sends two spies. Our tradition has it that the two spies were Kalev, his colleague, and Pinchas. And he sends them two spies and tells them to go and just check out the land before they go and conquer it. And to enter the city of Jericho, which was considered the entry point into the land of Israel. It's on the southeastern border. And they go, and they were supposed to make it a very quiet mission, an intelligence mission. Jews were good at that even those times. And to come back and report. So they go and they come into the city of Jericho. And they stay by a woman called Rahav. Right? And Rahav was an interesting person. Now again, I'm telling you first the story the way it is, and then we're going to decipher it. The pasuk, the verse, refers to this woman called Rahav as Rahav Hazona, which has two meanings in the Talmud. The word zana either comes from the word lazun, to sustain. She was an innkeeper. She had a bed and breakfast. It was a normal place to stay. Or it has a very other interesting interpretation, that she was a promiscuous woman. She was a harlot. She was a zana. She was znut, from the unfaithfulness, adultery, promiscuity, and so on and so forth. Either way, the only connection between the two interpretations is that she knew everything about everyone. And from a spy point of view, from an intelligence point of view, it was a good place to stay. Now, Jericho had a king. And the king found out that these two people are around, so she sends a message. He sends a message to Rahab. Well, she hears that there's a messenger coming to the king, is looking for these two people. They were discovered. So surprisingly, instead of giving them up, what does she do? She takes them to the roof. And she hides them, the verse tells us, under flax plants. She had these flax plants on the roof, and she hides them under the flax plants. Then the two messengers of the king show up, and they say, well, we believe there's two people. So what she says, look, yes, absolutely, there were two people here, but you're a bit late. They've gone already. So why don't you run? She gives them a direction to run after them, which they do. After which, she goes up to the roof, and she tells them what happened. And she said, listen, I'm going to let you go. I'm going to help you escape. But before I help you escape, let me explain to you, let me say to you something, she says. I know why you're here. Rahab says to these two people, I know why you're here. We also have heard in this land, we have heard what God did to the Jewish people. We heard about the splitting of the sea 40 years ago. We understand you guys are on the way to conquer this land. We know you're going to win. And we know you're going to win because she tells them, I can tell you, she says, that there's no spirit left. There's no drive. There's no spirit left in the rulership and the leadership of this country. So this land will be easy for you to actually conquer. I have one request, that when you conquer the land, spare me. Spare me. And they promised. And they said, well, you've done us a big favor. We will. So what does she do? And this is relevant later, you'll see. She takes them to the window. Now, this Rahab lived in the walls. It was very thick walls. She lived in the walls of the city of Jericho. So instead of going out the front door, she takes them to the window and says, I'm going to let you out. And she gives them a rope. And she lowers them down, and they run away. They go back the other side of the Jordan to where Moses and the Jewish people were. Okay? Understood the story so far? So, the Talmud has a very, very... This is the story in the Tanakh. The Talmud has a very interesting question. The Talmud says that when Rahab turned to the two spies and said to them, there's no spirit left in the leadership of this country, and this country will be easy for you to conquer, how did she know? How could she speak on behalf of the Jewish people? Of the Canaanite people? How did she know? How could she speak on behalf of all the dignitaries and the government leadership and so on and so forth? So the Talmud says... The Talmud is in two different places. I'm putting them both together to create the whole story. And the Talmud says the craziest thing. The Talmud says that Rahab, using the terminology we used before, was a zona. She was a promiscuous person. She was a person who had been doing this professionally for 50 years. And she was a person who all the dignitaries and all the members of the leadership of the corrupt land of Canaan, as it was in that time, came to her and used her services. So she knew them well. She knew what no other people knew. Then the Talmud goes on and says the craziest thing. Talmud says that she helped these two spies, and two things happened. First of all, she turned to God and she said the following. She said, God, I need to give this up. I need to change my life. It's been an empty life for the past 50 years. I need to change it. I need to change. She says to God, listen, I have sinned with flax, with windows, and with ropes. Now, what does that mean? So the commentary explained, very simple, because she did the same thing with everyone else that came to her. She used to get the high-level politicians coming to her. then someone else would knock on the door, so she'd hide them in the flax. No one wanted to know but anyone else. Right? Not that, you know, this is not something we can relate to today as well. We hear about different kinds of stories in high-level government sometimes, yeah? So, it's just the way it is. So she used to hide them in the flax, and then she had this advantage of living in the wall. So when the coast was clear, in order that the people coming to her shouldn't go back out the front gate and be on the CNN headlines the next morning, she used to take them to the window and let them out with the rope. So she says to God, for the past 50 years, I have sinned with flax, with a window, and with rope. But now, she says, I've done something good with the flax, the window, and the rope, and I'm asking you, therefore, to forgive me. And then the Talmud continues on with something that's even more bizarre. And the Talmud says that what happened was, when Joshua entered the land of Israel with the Jewish people, she converted. She repented and converted and married Joshua, the leader of the Jewish people. And they had such a holy relationship that seven prophets and one prophetess, Huldah HaNaviah, of the greatest prophets, came from her. Jeremiah, Yechezkel, Huldah the prophetess, these are the greatest of the great, some of them are Kohanim even, were descendants of Joshua and Rahab, who read such a low life beforehand, and then did such a turnaround, converted, married Joshua, and out of her came these unbelievable people. To the point that there's a fascinating medrash, and the medrash says like this. There's a medrash that the medrash talks about the concept of tshuva, the concept of repentance. And the medrash says, G'dola tshuva yoter mitfila, tshuva, repentance and self-change is greater than prayer, even though we always talk about the greatness of prayer. Why? Because Moses prayed hundreds of times to go into the land of Israel. Moses prayed hundreds of times to go into the land of Israel, and it wasn't answered. And Rahab turned to God and did tshuva, and she was accepted and answered to the point that she was able to marry Joshua and have these great descendants. And then the Midrash continues and says that Rahab comes from the word rachvut, expansive, that she had tremendous merits. She was a wide person, she was a broad person, her scope was broad, her reach was broad, her power was broad. In other words, the Midrash is describing her in great terms. That's the story. So the two obvious questions is this. First of all, we understand that tshuva is great, right? Yes, everyone can change. But it's a little exaggerated. I mean, to live a life like that for so many years and then to do tshuva to the point that Joshua is ready to marry her. I mean, you know, when Joshua looks for a shidduch, he probably looks like they say with a bit of yichas, you know, right? Not someone who's lived that kind of life for 40, 50 years. Okay, she become part of the community, we'll accept her, but befitting to marry Joshua, what does all this mean? Right? And secondly, we need to understand is this. What is the story? What's this business with the flax, the window, and the rope? What is that all about? The Talmud just doesn't say story just like that. It seems like almost irrelevant information. And it seems like also what she said was just a nice play of words. God, you know what did I say? I sinned with the flax, the window, and the rope. But now I've done something good with the flax, the window, and the rope. You know, I hid the spies, I let them out. Big deal, it was a one-time thing. I mean, seriously, you don't really think that the flax, the window, and the rope, one time saving two spies, would suddenly wipe away 40, 50 years of a real immoral lifestyle? I mean, what is that supposed to mean? And what's going on here? There's something deeper. There's obviously something deeper in the emphasis and the overemphasis on the flax, the window, and the rope. So this is where the Maharal comes into it, the Maharal of Prague, and says something very briefly and cryptically, but drawing out from what the Maharal says, one can learn an unbelievable formula. And it's such a relevant thing, and it's goes to the heart of what we've been talking about in the last few weeks. Basically, it works like this. The flax, the window, and the rope represent three integral and critical parts of the human experience that so often happens And those three parts of that human experience can lead a person down the path of absolute destruction, or it can lead a person down the path of amazing greatness. Let's understand. Let me just say it briefly, and then I'm going to develop it a little bit. The flax, what is flax? In Hebrew, the word for flax is bud. In fact, the high priest, if you look in the Chumash, when the high priest went into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur, normally he wore very elaborate clothing, but on Yom Kippur, he was told to wear big day bud, linen clothing, flax, made out of flax. What does the word bud come from? In Hebrew, the word bad comes from badad, loneliness, or levad, alone. Why? Because we are taught that when flax grows, it's different to a tree. Flax doesn't grow like a tree which has many branches coming out of the same tree and all being connected to the same tree. But flax grows in lonely stalks. Each stalk grows alone. And that's why pishtan, bad, in other words, linen, flax, is a symbol of loneliness. Okay? What does it represent? Okay, we'll talk about it soon what it represents. Let me just go through each one. What does the window represent? The window represents perspective, the paradigm, our outlook on the world, how we look out into the rest of the world. It represents exploration, when we start exploring different things, to search, to look for things. We look out of our internal window. We all have a window. We look out of that window to see what's going on, to see what's taking place out there in society. And what happens is that after we explore the world, we use a rope. What's a rope? A rope is something that connects two people, two things. We throw a rope. We all do this. We make connections, sometimes good connections, sometimes bad connections. But we make connections between us and the world around us. We create relationships, good or bad. We create relationships with experiences, with things, good or bad. Right? So what does all this mean? If we understand this concept of pishtan being a loneliness, bud, flax being a sense of loneliness, window being a perspective and the rope being a connection, we can understand the deeper perspective of the story of Rahav. And we can understand what motivated her and other people to first behave in one way for a very long extended period of time, and then afterwards to behave in a very, very positive way. But it's not just with Rahav, it's with many, many, many people at different levels and different extremes. So how does it all work? It works like this. What it explains is that often in life it begins with flax. Meaning, people often grow up with a deep, in fact, many of us grow up like that, on different levels, with a deep sense of loneliness. In other words, we have, deep down, at the very core of our soul, we have a feeling of isolation. And because we have a feeling of isolation, there's a craving, a need to connect to something. There's a need to go out there and fulfill that loneliness or treat that loneliness with something. Something that will fulfill us. Something that will make us feel less isolated. Something that will make us feel less lonely. Some people think it's Facebook friends, but it's not. You can have 9,000 Facebook friends and still feel lonely. We'll see later why. And sometimes people can be very social and still feel lonely. Because that feeling of loneliness and that need to connect, it's really what it is. It's really to connect to something of meaning. Something that's going to be deep. Something that's going to take away that sense of isolation and sense of loneliness. So what do? When we have that feeling, we have that craving, we start to explore. We look out the window and we peek out and search connections. We search things to connect to that will alleviate that loneliness. And then what we do is we throw a rope and we create a connection. We connect to something which we believe will take away that loneliness. Now, that loneliness, by the way, can come from all different reasons. Sometimes it comes from a feeling of abandonment, a feeling of insecurity. Sometimes it comes from a very deep place, a place to connect, because often people, and this is the sad part about how society often works, not everyone fits into the mainstream. Some people were born with incredible levels of creativity and are drawn to amazing greatness and amazing things and such depth that what they normally offered in the mainstream growing up just doesn't work for them. And therefore they still feel that abandonment, they still feel that loneliness. Right? And the truth is that this applies to many, many, many people in so many different forms and so many different ways. It's just each one of us can find that need, they find that desire somewhere as we grow up. Yeah. Yeah, no, it has to happen. We're designed to have a loneliness, because what happens is, we'll see later, every person, and some people more than others, but every person is created with some level of need to connect to something meaningful, because we're not meant to be alone. See, going back to the very, very beginning of creation, when God created us, He created us to have relationships. And I don't only mean relationships with people necessarily, relationships with the rest of the world, relationships with existence, relationships with meaning, right? Which is why we start off very often with a sense of loneliness. And for some people, that sense of loneliness is incredibly strong, because they actually have a very deep craving, a very deep yearning to connect, and connect in a very, very deep way. The problem is that when we grow up and we have that sense of loneliness that can happen for all different things, we look at it through our own window, meaning we create our own paradigm. Because the problem is, as we start to explore and we start to look out the window, we look out the window using our own glasses. So the color we see outside there is our own paradigm, our own perspective. We're looking through tainted eyes a lot of the times. And therefore, often when we look out the window to create connections, we're not actually aware of the real essence of what our loneliness is all about. And we're not aware, and we're not really conscious of what we should do about that loneliness and how we should create that experience that would alleviate that loneliness. So what do? And this is where it all starts. And this is where that subconscious signals comes in that we've been talking about the last 3 weeks. We misinterpret that loneliness. And we misinterpret the solution, because we're looking outside there, looking for things, but we're looking through our own paradigm. So what do? We look for quick fixes. We look for quick relationships. We look for instant gratification. We look for pleasure. We look for things that will make us feel good, which never works. It does make us feel good temporarily, but it doesn't make us fulfilled. It doesn't give us meaning. And sometimes the greater the loneliness, the lower we fall. Rabbi Twersky said once at a retreat which dealt with addictions and all kinds of substance abuse and all kinds of problems. He said that in the many, many decades, this is an amazing thought, in the many, many decades of him working in the area of rehabilitation and working in alcohol addiction, but many, many different forms of addiction, he has come up with that. He was asked if all the people that fall that low and become addicted or become involved in all sort of destructive behaviors, is there any common theme that connects them? And he said the most amazing thing. He said in all these years of working in rehabilitation, he has found one common theme that binds all addicts together. That if you look at them properly, they are all deeply sensitive and spiritual people. It's incredible. And it's precisely often that those people who are so deeply spiritual and so deeply sensitive and such have this deep and strong and powerful yearning, which results in their deep and strong and powerful loneliness, are the ones that get caught up in the worst forms of behavior. Because no one taught them, or no one guided them, or no one helped them guide and channel that sense of loneliness to a real journey of fulfillment. Or it could come, that deep loneliness could come from a feeling of abandonment. I just heard last night the most amazing thing. They had in New York, they had a forum for people sharing their own stories of survival from addiction and from all different types of mental health issues. And this one particular person got up and told such an amazing story. His own story. What unbelievably brave and unbelievably courageous. Of a life of addiction to alcohol and then to drugs. And the battle that he had to sort of get over. It was the most amazing thing. And in essence, he described, I'm not sure if he's familiar with this idea, but he described loneliness. And he kept on saying the one word over and over again, that he always had this feeling he doesn't belong. He doesn't belong. He's not connecting. He doesn't belong to anyone. He doesn't belong to any group. He didn't feel like he belonged. And right from a very, very young age. And it wasn't this particular speaker. I mean, there were other people that had external influences in their lives, like abuse and things like that, that kind of might have influenced the way they took, and that often does happen, because that often taints the window and you look for things in a different, much, much more distorted way. But for him, it was more, maybe it was just a bit different. Maybe he just had a different yearning, a different sense of loneliness to the mainstream group. And he was, from a very young age, he wasn't exposed to any real negative experiences. It was just that he couldn't find himself. And then the day he just searched and searched and landed up unbelievably low until he hit rock bottom, and there were some people who helped him along the way until he actually saw that no, he's got to help himself. He's now five and a half years completely clean and living an unbelievably productive and full life, helping lots of other people. Incidentally, just to digress for a moment, this one of the greatness of this forum that I just listened to this last night, amazing, there were like four speakers, and they created this discussion for one purpose, and the purpose was to show people that there's hope. Right, and they sort of, one of the rules of the speakers were they're not allowed to blame in their speech, at least, and they're not allowed to deal with any of the negativity. They're not focused on the dark. And that's the most powerful message. No matter how low you fall, there's this tremendous hope. And there is hope, and there is help, and you can get it, and so on and so forth, which is an incredible message. But it's a message sometimes that we have to learn too. You don't have to fall that low to be able to need help. We can just go through the regular challenges of life and also know there's help. We can even go through experiences which are just negative, not in a clinical sense, but, you know, we're not motivated, or we get angry, or we have feelings of revenge, or whatever the case is, not at an addictive and destructive level, that we should always believe in ourselves to know that there is hope, as we'll see a little bit later. So this is what happens. So the person has a deep sense of loneliness, which is the flax. Not knowing how to channel it, they look through the window and explore, but from their own distorted perception sometimes, or their own distorted, tainted glasses. And then we end up throwing a rope and making connections, and often that connection is just quick fixes and things that will make us feel good, but it never seems to work, and we just want more and more, and we fall lower and lower. Which is exactly what happened with Rachav. Rachav, the Medrash says, the word Rachav comes from Rachav, wide. She was a very, very deep soul, this Rachav. We'll see later Kabbalistically what this means. Fascinating idea I'll share with you. Hope we'll have time. So this Rachav was a very, very deep soul. She was broad. And because she was broad, she had this yearning, this intense yearning, which resulted in this intense, powerful loneliness. But not knowing what to do with it, she started looking through the window, and eventually for 40, 50 years, the Talmud said, she threw ropes. But the ropes was connections which are superficial. Connections which had no loyalty, no depth, no effort, no vision, no commitment. And she ended up living that life of promiscuity. Why? Because she just kept on looking for those connections, but the connections wasn't one she was willing to work for. She wasn't willing to think long term. She wasn't willing to understand the real depth of what was going to fill that need that she really felt so deep in her neshama. So she just kept on doing that. She kept on repeating the very, very, very shallow relationships. She was the first Facebook user, you know what I'm saying? Like, she was looking for shallow... No, not... I don't mean Facebook is such a bad thing. I use Facebook too, but... It could be a bad thing, right? She had 3 million friends, but no friends. No committed relationships, no deep relationships, right? And she kept going. Until... See, that's something we've talked about many, many, many times. The confusion between pursuit of pleasure and real happiness. That's really what this is. Because often the pursuit of pleasure comes because there's something driving it. The people who cannot help themselves and cannot stop themselves, and or if it even derails into real addiction, but even before addiction, sometimes we pursue things and we pursue pleasure because we're trying to fill a void. We're trying to fill a need. And that need is real. It's true, and it's actually positive. We just don't know what to do about it. That need is created like a loneliness, and we need to connect. And then we look through the wrong window, we connect through the wrong way. So she just ran further and further and threw more and more ropes and became more and more lonely. And as she became more and more lonely, she kept doing it more and more to fill that loneliness, and always doing it in a mistaken way and a shallow way with no commitment and no depth. Until she discovers two messengers of Yahushua who come. And she starts to rethink her whole life. And she encounters with them. She obviously engages them. She talks to them. She learns about the Jewish people. She learns about Matan Torah. She learns about the moral compass. Something we're going to learn about in 2 weeks' time on Shavuot. She starts to understand about what the Jewish people want to do and what they want to accomplish and where they want to go in the terms of coming into the land and what type of life they want to lead, not just a life of materialism, but a life of meaning and purpose. And it's at that moment that something switches. She realizes this hasn't worked. It's 40, 50 years and it hasn't worked. And she realizes that she's got her flax and her window and her rope all wrong. So she hides them in the flax. She uses the flax for something positive. She takes them to the window and gives them a rope. And then she turns to God. And this is the depth of what she says. She wasn't saying to God, you know, I've sinned with these three things all these years, and now I've done one mitzvah with these three things. Boom, I'm okay, I'm clean. No. She wasn't saying that at all. What she was saying to God is, I've come to a very deep realization. I've come to acknowledge, I've had this light bulb moment, the switch that's taken place in my mind, where I know that this hasn't worked. It's been really bad and it's gotten me to such a low place, but I'm still ready to change. Why? Because you don't have to change. That's the point. We just have to rechannel. Rahav was good inherently. It was all coming from a very deep place. She didn't have to go through a metamorphosis in terms of changing who she was. She had to channel who she was. And she turns to God and she says, I want you to help me because I now realize. I'm now conscious of the depth of the flax, the window, and the rope. I now understand what has taken place. I now understand that I've had the sense of flax all these years, this deep sense of loneliness, but I've looked through the wrong window and I've thrown the wrong rope and made bad connections. So I'm asking you, in the schut, in the merit of helping these people with these three items, help me change my flax, my window, and my connection. And that's what she did. And because we have a few minutes, I don't need to do this because to bring out the point, but I want to share with you anyways. Because in Kabbalah, there's a concept called, because this will make it just more powerful. In Kabbalah, there's a concept called Gilgulim, reincarnations. We believe people come from other people and so on and so forth. And some of the Kabbalists wrote a book called Sefer HaGilgulim, fascinating stuff, throughout the ages and throughout Tanakh, to know which soul was connected to who. And we understand so many stories of the Chumash through understanding this. This is fascinating stuff. There's many, many shiurim we've given on this about different people and how they connect to each other, and Korach and Moshe Rabbeinu and Yitro and Adam and so on and so forth. But in terms of this story, let me take you back. This story didn't start with Rahav and Joshua. This story started way before, which will explain why she ended up marrying Joshua and why they became such a deep relationship, which gave birth to such unbelievable prophets. It was putting the real connection, was looking through the right window and creating the right and deep relationship. Why? It didn't start then. It started long before. It started with the story of Joseph. When Joseph was sent down to Mitzrayim, to Egypt, when he was 17, he was sold by his brothers. And he lands up in slavery, and he lands up working for a person called Potiphar. Right? I'm behind, I think, on these slides. Yep, here we are. So the Kabbalah tells us that Joshua was a reincarnation. He was the same soul as Joseph. You'll see why in a second. And Rahab was a reincarnation of the wife of Potiphar. Now, what was the story? You might know the story, you might not. Let me just tell you the story just in case. Joseph lands up, he was a young boy in the house of Potiphar, alone. You can imagine how lonely he was. Right? And a great soul, an unbelievable soul, a soul that was misunderstood, like many of the lonely souls, by his brothers. They sold him into slavery. He was a greater tzaddik. He was more than he's the only person which we refer to called Yosef at tzaddik. They were all righteous, they were all holy, but they were more mainstream. He was different. And he was misunderstood by his brothers, and they ended up selling him into slavery. He comes, and suddenly this bizarre story, the wife of Potipharah decides she wants to seduce him. She was, and a crazy story. What happened was that he kept on saying no, and then one day he almost succumbed. The Torah tells us, it's in the Chumash, the Torah tells us that one day, it was a day, some sort of festival happened in Egypt, and no one was home. She feigned sickness. She told her she can't go to the festivity, she's staying home. And he was a slave, so he came home, he came to the house to do his job, to do his daily jobs, I don't know, clean the rooms, to set the table, whatever it was. And she corners him and she says, let's do it. Now if you look in the Chumash, it says, Vayima'en, he refused. But it's not so simple. Because you know in the Chumash there are notations, musical notations on top of the words and other words. And one of the very rare ones is something called a shalshelet, it's a zigzag. And on top of this word, Vayima'en, he refused, there's a zigzag. And I once read in a fascinating article by Rabbi Sachs, he brings one of the commentators, that the zigzag always resembles hesitance and ambivalence and struggle. Why is this? Because if you look in the Talmud, he didn't just refuse. He almost gave in. And listen to what happened. Listen to what happened. The Talmud says that as he was about to give in, he suddenly saw a vision of his father's face, Yaakov. But look what the Talmud says. Oh, you okay? Oh, okay. The Talmud says he saw, this is powerful, listen to this. He saw the vision of his father's face, Bachalon, in the window. That's what it says. That's what it says, Talmud. Unrelated. In the window. Why in the window? I mean, if he had a prophetic vision, why in the window? And he knew what his father looked like. It wasn't like he didn't know what his father looked like. He was, right? So the commentators explain like this. What happened was like this. Potipharah's wife, I'm calling her Potipharah's wife because she doesn't have a name in the Chumash for some reason. She's called the wife of Potipharah. As kids, we used to say Mrs. Potipharah. She had a name. I'll tell you a name, but she doesn't have a name. In the Chumash, at least, right? Eshet Potipharah. Maybe because it emphasized the problem, because she was married, right? The Talmud says she wasn't such an evil person either, by the way. She actually had a spiritual sensitivity, also didn't know how to channel it properly. And she saw that her soul and Joseph's soul are somehow connected. And in fact, it was to be. Because eventually, her soul, in the form of Rahav, married Joshua, who was Joseph's soul. It was meant to be. But there are many things Kabbalah teaches us that are meant to be, but they have to happen at the right time and in the right way with the right preparation. And if they happen when they're premature, it lands up destructive. So she saw this, so she tried to seduce him, but in an immoral way, in the context of she was still married, she was married and he was a young boy. It wasn't meant to be at that time and it wasn't supposed to be. And had it happened at that time, it would have been promiscuous and it would have been immoral. And Yosef almost gave in. Why? Because if Rachav was lonely, you can imagine how Yosef was lonely. A 70-year-old boy, away from his family, no social media, no WhatsApp, no fax, no nothing. He hadn't heard from his family, he was completely abandoned. And he had the soul which was deep, he had the soul which yearned, he had the soul that wanted to accomplish. You remember that Yosef was the one called Yosef the dreamer. He dreamt all these different dreams about his brothers coming to him and he would rule them and he would fix the world. And they were good dreams, they were holy dreams, we are taught. But they were dreams, they were aspirations, they were ambitions. Yosef was a churning soul. And he had no fulfillment, he was stuck in Egypt. Can you imagine a soul on fire like that, stuck nowhere in Egypt? So you can imagine how lonely that is and what kind of feeling of abandonment it is. And therefore he starts to explore and he starts to look at windows, but you can understand what kind of window could happen there and what he could start to see and how that can be distorted and tainted. He looks through a window and he's about to throw a rope to Potipharah's wife. He's about to give in. Where suddenly, he says he saw the vision of his father in the window. And the commentaries explain a beautiful thing. What is it? What did that idea mean? What did he see? So it says he saw Yaakov looking at him. Which means he suddenly understood how Yaakov, his father, views him. Because what does it say by Yaakov? When Yosef was taken away, it says Yaakov refused to be comforted. It uses the same word, vayema'en, he refused. All his family tried to get him to move on, and it was a tragedy, and Yosef was missing, and he thought Yosef was dead, and so on and so forth. And it says, vayama'en, he refused to give up. Why? So let's transport it to modern times, when you have a child who's lonely, and a child that's about to do all terrible things, or is doing terrible things, or a person that's doing terrible things. What do? We say, that person is beyond repair. Point of no return. We start to give up on people. Yaakov, no. Yaakov looks at Yosef and he says, Vayema'en, he refused. And that's what Yosef saw in the window. Yosef saw in the window Yaakov looking at him and saying, I look at you as a person, I will never give up, because your burning loneliness you can channel in the right way. You're just looking in the wrong window. Start to look at your own window. Start to look at your own potential. Start to look at your own depth. Start to look at what you're really capable of, and really capable of investing in and creating, and do it the right way. And at that moment, Yosef was about to give up, because he was about just to look for the instant fix. Suddenly stood, no, it's a long-term battle, but he's capable of it. And he refuses, not without a struggle. He refuses with that zigzag on top, and he doesn't do it. Rachav went through the same process. Rachav also had the wrong window. She looked through a different window, and therefore threw the wrong rope, until she realized that she was Rachav. She had broad achievements to make, that she had a powerful soul, and if she channels it in the right way, she can do it right. And that switch is what happens when those two people came. And she turns to God and she says, help me channel my soul, my loneliness, my flax, my window, and my rope in the right way. And then when the Jews come into Israel, the two souls meet. And at that point, it's ready to happen, but happen in a deep way. Happen in a way of commitment and loyalty and spirituality. And those two souls are able to re-energize and come together, and they unite. And out of them comes the greatest prophets and the greatest Jewish leaders. But at the end of the day, however, the story is not just about Rachav and Yeshua. The story is about every one of us. And going back to the stories, the things we've been talking about the last few weeks, what happens is we have our personality, and our personality is cooking, it's on fire, and it's coming, that fire, that desires, the thing, the motivation that we have, which often is negative motivation, and the more negative it is, it's because it's coming from a deeper place. Because at the very essence of our soul, going back to the layers of the personality, right? Let's just bring that up again. Yep. At the very essence of who we are, we want to do the wrong thing. We want to do the right thing. We want to achieve. We want to connect. We want to bring meaning and purpose and fulfillment to our life. And that's where the desire starts. But often we're not conscious of it. We don't realize where that desire, that unsettledness is coming from, where that loneliness is coming from. So what happens is the subconscious, as we talked about over the last few weeks, in an erroneous attempt to protect the person, feeds these thoughts into our conscious mind, which feeds negative emotions to quick fix it, to throw the rope in the wrong place. Our window becomes distorted, our paradigm becomes distorted, and we throw it to the wrong place. And we create bad connections. We create superficial connections. We eat, we seek pleasure, we build bad relationships, whatever it is. Or sometimes people sink very, very low. But just like Rachav, and this is such a powerful message, just like Rachav, who did this for 50 years, at the end of the day could re-channel her rope, her flax, her window, her rope, and she could discover what was really behind it all, and find the right focus, and the right direction, and the right paradigm, and the right window, and the right rope, and the right connection, which resulted in the most amazing, most powerful union, we can do that too. In other words, we don't have to completely become a different human being. We have to channel who we are. As I said many, many times, this often happens with parenting. Sometimes we see bad things or bad character traits in children, we want to suppress it. And sometimes, temporarily we do. When one kid is almost about to kill another kid, we have to just stop it, right? But that's a temporary measure. Really, we have to do is sometimes we have to see, why is a person behaving like that? Why are like this? It's like I said before, Rabbi Twersky said that the addicts are the most spiritual people, because they've just felt such a sense of abandonment and loneliness, and they have nowhere to put it, and they end up putting it in the wrong places. We too, we do that sometimes also. We look for superficial things. We numb ourselves or distract ourselves like the subconscious mind does. We just distract ourselves with very superficial and sometimes destructive things. We get angry because we want to just feel good now. We look for the wrong pleasure. We become obsessed with having things or becoming happy with things that we know won't bring us true happiness and meaning and purpose because we want it now. We just want to distract ourselves. And we keep distracting that sense of loneliness, not being conscious of where we really want to go. But when we make that switch and we understand that we have our conscious mind back in control and we're able to think and we realize we connect our conscious mind to the essence, we realize where it's all coming from and we start to reconfigure the window. We start to reconfigure the place of exploration. We start to reconfigure what we're really looking for and become ready to put in the effort and to think long term, as we said last week, and to understand what is really going to bring us meaning, what is really going to bring us purpose, and therefore what is really going to bring us inner happiness, then we're able to throw the rope in the right place, in a place which will take work. Yes, it does take work, one step at a time, but a place that will make us more powerful and will bring us real meaning and real purpose and real happiness. And that's the lesson from Rachav, which ties into what we've been talking about over the last few weeks. But next week, we're going to put it all together and just finish off the series. As I said, next week finishes the series. Then I'm going to take a few weeks break. I'm traveling overseas, but I'll give you the topic and the dates of the series next week. Don't forget, if you haven't bought a raffle ticket, to please see the office, and have a wonderful week.